This is an unrehearsed interview with Orlin Corey, a professor of speech at Georgetown College, 1952 to 1959, by Dr. Glenn Tall, archivist. The interview took place in the Inter Learning Resource Center of Georgetown College on September 9th, 2002. What I'm interested in is the different issues that were surrounding the college during the time, and some of the very things that you're talking, researching for your book. But first of all, tell me, when did you come to Georgetown, and how, why did you come to Georgetown? How did you find out about it and so forth?
I was finishing a master's degree in drama at Baylor University in the early spring of 1952, or winter. And at that time, I heard of the Southern Speech Association, which was meeting in Jackson, Mississippi that year. Now, whether they still exist 50 years later, I'm not sure, but they were important at that time in the national scene. And I was advised it'd be good to go over there and seek a position. So I went over, and in that time in my life, I was about 26. I'd been in the Navy the last 2 years of the Second World War, so I was a little behind by age. Mm-hmm. So I was about 26 at that time.
Okay.
And Rena Calhoun was there from Georgetown College in Kentucky.
Okay.
And I was just aware of that name. I didn't know anything else about it. And she was looking for a person to come to the department, I learned.
Mm-hmm.
And she was relying on her friend, Dr. Charles McGlaughan, who headed the speech work at Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, and so she knew him here in the state. She was relying on him for advice. I think I saw him in reference to a master's thesis I was working on, and then he suggested I talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, and about a month passes, and I was invited to send a resume. It all went at a very leisurely pace.
Mm-hmm.
And would like to have an interview with me. Well, the interview wasn't feasible until we got to June that year, a couple of months later. But everything seemed copacetic, so that was okay. The interview was because my wife, Irene, by name at that time, and herself, a four-year teacher of art at Baylor, we're the same age with the difference in the Navy and all that. What's the difference in that? But she'd been teaching nearly 4 years at Baylor. And we were on our way to Europe for the summer, for a summer study. So we're driving with friends who were going with us.
Uh-huh.
We came through. I was interviewed that afternoon by Rena Calhoun and by Chancellor Leonard Smith. And in the course of that interview, which went quite charmingly, he really conducted it because she had recommended him to me. And he was announced as of that morning their art department, in the form of the one person it was, had resigned. So he interviewed Irene on the spot the next hour while I was giving the tour of the campus. We were both offered the jobs before we left, and we signed and left Georgetown with contracts to start teaching here that fall. Now that's a long, unexpected answer.
My goodness. You mean, so you never did meet the president before you
No,
were
I never
hired.
Met Dr. Hill until I arrived in September.
And what was your impression of him?
He's fine. Very much a Virginia parson. I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, but in a formal sense, almost an Episcopal sense of presence about himself, and certainly a Baptist too, but very reserved and imposing appearance and good voice, and was very aware of the social amenities of the world. That was quite clear in the way the table was set, the way the talk went, and the way everything was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Chancellor Smith had the responsibility for employing.
Is that right?
Or did at that time.
Yeah.
I cannot speak before that moment, but that's how I met him.
And then what year was this?
1952.
Okay.
So in September, we came here. Excuse me.
Oh, that's right.
In very early September.
Mm-hmm.
and moved into an apartment on Military Street, upstairs above where Coleman Arnold lived.
Is that right?
So there began a long friendship.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what were you hired to do? Now, you were hired by in the speech department.
It was the speech department.
Uh-huh. And I know Mrs. Go ahead.
Well, Rena Calhoun was the speech department.
Yeah.
However, it had grown to the point that they had a debate person, Mrs. Dorothy Melzer, who was very capable.
Mm-hmm.
Very capable with that, did a superb job with it. And these things had naturally grown. It's the history of the speech world that they came out of English. And used to be English in speech.
Uh-huh.
Then speech appeared. This is in the history of that bit of the academic world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the drama, if it was allowed, either started in English as a literary study,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes crept out onto a stage and began to, in this case, it came through speech. So in the course of time, in 1954, this had become a speech and drama department, which meant instead of the speech major having one or two drama courses, the speech and drama major had courses of both. Kind of a hybrid, a perfectly compatible mix.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so Dorothy Melzer was already there, and the student radio station had just started, but this was really student-operated, but it was under the general supervision of the speech department. I was brought in to help be technical assistant in doing the plays, which she would direct, and I believe they directed two plays a year at that time, and
mm-hmm.
Lewis Auditorium was a very new facility then in Giddings Hall. Been there maybe a couple of years by then as a stage.
Okay.
And so I was brought in for that purpose and would also teach some basic courses. And then a stagecraft course came with that, which is a new course coming with me.
Okay.
And then I sought permission to direct in a different way, to direct a play that would be toured to churches, which seemed to be a logical extension from a Georgetown College speech department. This was allowed, and then also to form a community-based children's theater,
mm-hmm.
using the college students to help lead them. So in that sense, I became involved from the beginning in some of the drama side. But I came as a speech teacher with that responsibility.
Oh, okay. How did you teach speech at that time? What method or approach did you take? Was it a lecture? Was it engaging the students in interaction in the class?
Well, yes. Yeah. It was rooted in the, historically, in the old Greek sense of rhetoric.
Okay.
Certain objectives and clarity and research and facts, but constantly on the challenge of, they would give a speech, a theme would be announced,
mm-hmm.
and they would prepare a 2, 3, 4, hardly ever more than 5 minute speech in on that particular, their take on that particular
mm-hmm.
subject. Such as the cliche of the time would be what I did on my summer vacation.
Yeah.
Could
yeah.
start from there. But then as their interests appeared
mm-hmm.
and the whole sense of the logic and preparation of this of the speeches worked.
Mm-hmm.
Speeches of persuasion, speeches of information, speeches of those categories would develop.
Okay.
So it was constantly a theory and then practice on their part. As I recall, it's been some years since I did this. I did this for several years. I think with me, in the course of the semester, they did 8 speeches.
Okay.
Which kept them pretty busy as these kept growing in requirements.
Okay.
Some were research topics, obviously connecting back again to the library and so forth. So that was a general approach on the speech. Then oral interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
would be another side of this, which is simply what it implies, reading aloud.
Was that a new feature in the 50s?
Well, no. That really came out of the old schools of rhetoric, and at one time was called expression. in the 1880s and 90s, just before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
But I can persuade some people now, I remember when that happened. And they believe me, which is more startling.
Uh-huh.
The joke disappears. The infusion of that side, which is clearly a child of, ultimately, of public speaking, but also the stage.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, the analysis of literature.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we present this effectively to an audience beyond our own research and background? Something I personally continue doing constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm
don't they call
about
that,
to do this.
Now. Don't they call that oral interpretation now?
Well, at that time it was called, it was expression in the 19th century. It became oral interpretation, and the courses were called, or interpretation courses.
Okay.
And usually just something called interp. In the vernacular, one and two, and then you could have advanced, and the full title of the category would be oral interpretation.
Okay.
To make the distinction between the written and.
And
the,
this might be include poetry or
poetry,
dialogue,
rhetoric, or, possibly dialogue. Your raw materials would be any literary form that was meant to be shared aloud. That would be poetry,
mm-hmm.
public address. I mean. Webster, Daniel Webster, Lincoln, Wilson, all the material, Gladstone, mm-hmm. the history of that, and then in more recent times, Roosevelt and Churchill and so forth. And so that would be part, and many would-be lawyers were advised and took often to great advantage. And then they would often shift over into the debate side,
mm-hmm.
which also had some courses.
Mm-hmm.
So there they got into it, which I think was wonderful for them to do.
Now, today they have a whole, the whole thing is called forensics.
Well, yes, yes, or whatever, or communication today.
Yeah, that's the big umbrella.
But that's the current umbrella is communication skills,
well,
department, or whatever.
Well, here it's called communication arts.
Okay, all right.
Which, under that umbrella, you've got drama, you've got speech, you've mm-hmm. got debate.
You probably have television now.
Television.
And film, cinema. Yeah, mm-hmm. which also crept in through, basically, again, out of the old theater, really.
Uh-huh.
The acting out or the showing forth of what the ideas are about. Now, this is all, what has happened in Georgetown is root and branch of the history of these fields as they've evolved through the country.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't anything distinctive about the way it appeared here, they were simply following the practice of
well,
the time.
Well, when you came here, what stage of development was
it was
Georgetown?
Just the speech department at that time.
Okay. So
it was free of English. It had come out of English here.
Okay.
Which is in the tradition when it's greater, not the tradition of that field.
Of course, in the 19th century, the curriculum was rhetoric.
That's right.
I mean, and it was, mm-hmm. and rhetoric was infused in every subject.
Of course. Yeah. Yes. And classes were taught that way.
Yes.
But eventually other approaches evolved simply because there's room for them and there's need for them.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, in the course of that time, then the drama, the radio moved into that, just as then the television subsequently did. As did the...
You want me to get you some water?
I beg your pardon?
You want me to get you some water?
I think I'm okay at the moment. Thank
okay.
you. Thank you. Anyway... So I was involved in that side, but also the oral interpretation courses, the fundamentals of speech course or public speaking one, or I forget how they termed it at the time. And I was doing that level,
mm-hmm.
then the stagecraft. And in a year or so, then there was a beginning acting class. And after a couple of years, it moved on to be accepted as a speech and drama approach. So a few more courses were added, and the major could do a pretty good balance of all of them,
mm-hmm.
or could also lean more, let's say, on the debate and the forensic side,
mm-hmm.
or lean more toward the oral interpretation and the stage side.
Mm-hmm.
They had three choices.
Was, from your judgment, was Georgetown behind the trends, or was it in the middle of the trend, or was it a...
My impression is it was very much in the general movement of that part of the field
mm-hmm.
across the country. In terms of its reputation mm-hmm. and work, what I mean in the general movement was the way it was structured was very much in what went on, was in the way that went on then.
Okay.
But in the practice, the debate people, which was certainly true at Baylor, in my background there,
mm-hmm.
were terrific and had high reputation in the state and the region.
Mm-hmm.
And often, you know, they could take on Ohio State or Indiana University or whatever.
Oh.
As equals. But certain teams in certain times could do this. So the size of what you came from wasn't necessarily proof that you would be better than the people that came from a little place. And that achievement was also true in, it became true on the drama side
mm-hmm.
in the 50s, but in several different ways. And so the drama programs in the state in the 50s, in the colleges, the University of Kentucky, let's see, University of Louisville had some, but not as much.
Mm-hmm.
It was all a little more, but Center and Transylvania tended to be about the same scale of things for the drama side.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 50s, all of them grew that mm-hmm. way into more activity. There was a statewide festival at that time that the University of Kentucky sponsored for plays.
Oh, for
and,
plays.
And specifically shifted it then to Shakespeare productions, and would have a Shakespeare festival. And the Georgetown production that Rena Calhoun had started, the annual Shakespeare, several years before that time.
Oh.
About 4 years before. And the spring I was there, it was As You Like It was chosen by her here. And she became, and small wonder, ill that winter. It was a time of much flu and so forth, that particular season. And she had her duties as she, you know, she was formerly dean of women, too.
Right.
And she had just stepped up, but she was still involved.
Yeah.
She lived in Rucker Hall. There was no way how you're going to escape the fact we'll go see Miss Rena about this or that, as well as the speech department
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And so I stepped in at her request. It was necessary to finish directing that play.
Mm-hmm.
And then we took it to the University of Kentucky, so I had an intimate sense of how to do what we did. We had 3 weeks to rehearse. She had a 2-week start. We had 3 additional weeks to bring it together.
Mm-hmm.
And though nobody officially judged who was best, the audience reaction was overwhelming. The Georgetown production was the best received.
Oh.
I'm sorry to say the university stopped having that year. Many years later, when I'm directing the American College Theatre Festival from the Kennedy Center,
mm-hmm.
we saw the same thing happening. If in the festival in regions, a smaller college would beat, say, the University of Washington
yeah.
or Yale,
yeah.
no Yale, no University of Washington the next year. Because after all, the right talent at the right moment
mm-hmm.
can go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
With a song of acting or speaking, it's obviously true.
Uh-huh.
It hurts the reputation of those who...
About what year was that? When
well, this As You Like It was in that first year. That was this the winter of 1953.
See,
it came September 52.
Okay.
Right. And all of that helped both Center, and it helped Transylvania
mm-hmm.
and Georgetown to help justify more activity on the state side.
Okay.
They were beneficial. I don't mean in any way to deny with that little laugh
mm-hmm.
that this did not have meaning at the university. It definitely did. It was very good of them to do this. They did it for several years.
Okay.
That was the last year they did it, though. And,
okay. So you made... Now, is this... When Mrs. Calhoun was sick and you had to step in to help her,
mm-hmm.
Did your responsibilities start increasing as regard to the mass crafters?
Well, I had to direct that play.
Okay.
My requirements were with that.
Okay.
Specifically that play.
That play.
And theoretically, the same relationship continued the next year in that she directed the two main stage plays. But by then, the touring play had come about, which I've just alluded to,
yeah.
in that 52-53 year, which went extensively and was well received. So much so, this was to become an annual feature. And that piece would be staged on the campus first, which became a third major production. So in effect, the Massgrafters had two directors at that time.
Oh, okay.
In the beginning, the concept of the church play was not so much, it was just another activity would be directed.
It was almost like an outreach tool.
Right, it was an outreach concept. But that was a very good thing for many reasons. Very good for students, mm-hmm. because they would have an experience quite different from 6 intense weeks on a major production here mm-hmm. on the campus, and then put it behind them. Mm-hmm. They would have, let us say, because these were shorter plays, maybe 4 intense weeks of rehearsal, and then they would have to revive it in different places about every 2 or 3 weeks for 6 months, mm-hmm. which was a real experience. And I'm convinced that some of the remarkable people that appeared through that time really grew because they had that challenge on top of their other challenges in the department, in debate or in other plays, mm-hmm. because there was time to grow and to learn things about themselves and about the audience and about the craft.
Now, the way the curriculum was set up at that time, were most all the students had to participate in some way in the speech or speech curriculum?
Well, I think there was a requirement that people take... there was a requirement that everyone on campus take a drama appreciation course. Mm-hmm. That was also in the beginning. There were like 4 sections in that.
Okay.
And so I did 2 of those. And then the next year I did 3 of them. After that, I did all of them.
Okay.
In addition to, you know, the beginning speech course, in addition to... So you see how the load would go. And I'm not complaining. It was pleasant. Mm-hmm. But casting in plays then was campus-wide. It was not limited to the department.
Okay.
And I don't know if they can continue that here or not. Now, the fashion today is to not do that, but I think it's a wonderful thing to bring in the football player to do something if he wants to. And sometimes
yeah,
he's great
aware
with it.
Of it. I'm not aware of it being done that way today.
It's the tendency now, it's a little like departments of music evolved so that those who are in their ensembles are studying in there. Mm-hmm. Which is
I know at Center College, I have attended plays there. They will, at certain times, they might draw in, like, they need kids' parts. So mm-hmm. they'll draw in community kids.
Yeah, from the community. Yeah.
Or they might draw, sometimes they might draw in somebody from the community, invite somebody from the community.
We did some of that for the same reason, for small children. Mm-hmm. But there was a tradition here again, and this was Miss Rena's doing, mm-hmm. And Wise. This is a very savvy, crafty, foxy, charming lady. She'd been here a while. She understood a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
When she did the Shakespeare, she first started the first Shakespearean play that had been done here, which went so well. Then they made they established the new tradition. Then, and first year we had a tradition. And sustained it. Mm-hmm. And that went on, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years until I left, and then I'm not sure. There was one then, and I think it probably became an occasional thing. Mm-hmm. But in any case, in the very beginning, she learned that Dr. George Redding, who was one of the original Massgrafters in 1924, and loved Shakespeare, and loved the stage, mm-hmm. he came over and he played Polonius in that first Hamlet production.
Oh.
And so he played a part in every one of those. Mm-hmm. And in As You Like It, he played Jaques. You know, he pretty much picked his part. And so you had a sense of age casting in it, which was terrific for the college student to work with.
Uh-huh.
Because he and such, others, a few others would appear too, uh-huh. when the Importance of Being Earnest was the first production of the Massgrafters in 1924.
Okay.
And that was started by a man named Professor James or Jimmy Moreland. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And his widow was alive at that time and lived in what was then called Faculty Apartments across the street from, it may still be there, I just don't know what's around now, mm-hmm. 50 years after this time.
Yeah.
But Mrs. Moreland, we made a point of meeting her and talking with her and inviting her to Massgrafter events. And when we got to that 54 production, Miss Rena, of course, did that again. They had revived this every 10 years. And the tradition was that every 10th year, which they started, the first time it was 10 years old was in 34, mm-hmm. the one who had played maybe Cecily or somebody else in that came back 10 years later and played Lady Bracknell.
Oh.
And the one in 34 was Lady Bracknell in 44, and that lady came back, Miss Mrs. Marchman, I think her name was, mm-hmm. in 54, and played the role again. So there was some of that tradition here always, which was, I think, a very rich kind of thing to do for a department of this size.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we had some of the age side. But what I meant is the open casting. We would announce a Shakespeare play, and anybody on the campus could come audition. It was not limited to majors in, or minors in the department.
Yeah.
And that is no longer quite the practice in many departments. They tend to be more like schools of music now that way. Mm-hmm. But the advantage is that department reached out by those events into all of those different houses. Mm-hmm. It helped change an attitude.
Yeah.
All the dorms, it wasn't just a group of people, the drama clique, going around like this, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was everybody was involved. And on one occasion, when we were doing, I forget which of the Shakespeare plays it was, it may have been the Macbeth, we asked all the boys to grow beards for many reasons. Mm-hmm. It saved makeup time, but it was also great advertising. And it was a badge. They even got talked against in some of the letters to the editor about who are these people, these nose brotherhood types, to use a reference to Baylor, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, they wouldn't use that phrase here, but it was by the same implication.
Yeah.
What's going on here, you know? It's the age of crew cuts, and they were growing beard down here and had crew cuts up here. But anyway, it made a great stage picture. So it worked through the campus. I very much believe in that.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. Like, tell me more about the church plays. Is this where you developed the Book of Job?
Well, ultimately that grew out of that phenomenon. The the concept was to do a play that was always meant to be mobile. In other words, it'd be costumes and actors and not sets.
Yeah.
And so it could be staged with a minimum of difficulty here, and budget was ever a problem.
Right.
Incidentally, Miss Calhoun had seen to it, probably Professor Moreland before her. I never knew he was dead before I came along. But the Masscrafters always had their own funds. That is, they had to make them, but they were administered by their student officers. And I could still hope that's true, but I dare say some administrators have been wise enough to stop that.
Yeah.
There's a wisdom the other way. There's a great wisdom in doing it, though, because it's their money and they work for it and use it better. And so it's their money that's invested to stage the next play.
Mm-hmm.
So they tend to be very responsible about it and work extra hard to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we had very little money for a new piece like this because it was planned only for two plays in here. So it was done very lightly, and budget-wise. And that particular first production was called Job, as a matter of fact. And it was a version adapted by Amy Goodhue Loomis at the time, and she had done this 20 years before in Michigan and then here and there. And I was familiar with that, and we staged that. And we did it mostly in old rags that were dyed nice colors. And a little simple platform smaller than this table, a few steps that we could move in a trailer and then take to church and set on the lectern. And not on a lectern, but on the platform.
Right.
And then a few portable lights, which was difficult to manage at the time, but with the budget in the background, but we were able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we started this by notifying, I think we went to, I don't remember, maybe the registrar at the time, Foley Snyder possibly, and said, what towns or cities or are there churches in that you think might be interested in? And these young people were from certain places too, which automatically meant certain possibilities were open. And if a church could manage this, and what they had to do was pay for the travel of the, in that case, I think it was a caravan of four cars and a trailer.
Yeah.
Four cars and a trailer, even about 25 people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the trailer for the platform and this and that. And could put us up overnight on the Saturday night, because we could hardly travel the day when you think of the size of the state.
Yeah.
Do it and come back again.
Yeah.
So spend Saturday night in their congregation, however they housed us.
Uh-huh.
So they put us up and feed us.
Mm-hmm.
And they paid our expenses. And there was a nominal royalty for the play, maybe $20 a performance, whatever Miss Loomis asked at the time, is what we paid for.
I mean, for the whole church to pay the $20.
Yeah, so they would be responsible for the travel of the troupe, the hospitality, putting them up, and whatever. That might be $100, $200 for the church total.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, it was his item at that time. But by word of mouth, in the first 3 months, this began to take off to the point we had to start saying no, mm-hmm. being very selective, because we didn't want to go more often than every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
As a real pusher. Uh-huh. And particularly when we're going to Paducah.
Oh.
On the roads of the time.
Yeah.
No interstates.
Two-lane roads.
And we were invited to Indianapolis.
Uh-huh. Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Cincinnati. All in the first year. And because I'd had some contacts in Waco and in Texas and had developed a program within a large church of drama, which was both drama secular and drama religious. It had both sides to it, for recreation and for worship purposes. It was very easy, and I did. We set up a tour down there at the end of spring.
Mm-hmm.
So we all took off down that way for 10 days and played in Houston and played in Austin and played in Dallas and Waco and Oklahoma City.
Uh-huh.
Listen, they were hooked. we were all exhausted.
Uh-huh.
But also, great experience. Well, now think of the size of the campus. People kept coming. They wanted to be involved.
Uh-huh.
The next year, we did a very small play.
Uh-huh.
We did Christopher Fry's A Sleep of Prisoners. Four men.
Okay.
Well, anyway, we did that piece in the chapel because the soldiers who were captured by an enemy,
mm-hmm.
and it's their dreams at night which are biblically connected, related. They're Cain and Abel, David and Absalom. So quite a beautiful piece. And that piece went so well that we really had a third on-campus major production. It ran 2 weekends in the chapel. And thus did not interfere with Lewis Auditorium and the plans for the fall there. Made some money, which helped all sides, you know,
uh-huh.
including the program back in Lewis.
Uh-huh.
And real advantages to that attitude.
Uh-huh.
And then I had a little caucus with Miss Kelly. We decided, well, maybe we better do a play for touring to churches. Because it developed that one of these fellows really couldn't travel.
Yeah.
And because he had a church. He was a religion major and he had a church, Bill Parsons by name. Oh, so we did every man. So back to four cars and a trailer and about 20 people, and I did a version of that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we had to hold this down as to how often we went. And then subsequently, year by year, there would be a major on-campus production in the chapel, which meant I was choosing pieces that matched, that fit.
That
fit that venue.
Yeah.
Yes. Dorothy Sayers, The Zeal of Thy House, not well known here, but was a second play at the Canterbury Festival in the 30s,
uh-huh.
about William Assange, who started Canterbury Cathedral.
Oh.
And so it's that story.
Oh, that sounds like an interesting story.
An interesting one in that chapel with two archangels who worked from the balcony above. Had great ladders that they descended.
Oh.
It was something to learn to descend forward, you know, as they were talking and so forth.
Yeah.
And interesting piece, and it worked like a charm. It ran six nights, a Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
And there was another major play going in?
Not at the same, but would be a building or rehearsing or...
All right.
Budgetary considerations and space were problems.
Right, right.
And we didn't tour that one. So we started doing one on campus.
Yeah.
And then we would do one for touring.
Now, about what year was this taking place?
Well,
that developed.
53, well, you see this grew out of the Job, which was 52, 53,
mm-hmm.
53, 54. Then 54, 55,
mm-hmm.
and then we had a year's leave in England from June of 55 to September 56,
mm-hmm.
and things downshifted a bit. But it came back with big force. They kept the Shakespearean play. They kept a number of things going. And by then, Lewis Auditorium was doing, I think, 3 or 4 productions a year, which is about enough when you have no space to build things. And yeah. It's complicated.
Yeah.
Everything you did had to be done on that stage.
So Lewis Auditorium was constructed when you came here.
It was here before I came. Just before I came.
Just before you came. So it was practically new.
Yes, that adaptation was practically new. And then we, the Massgrafters, who had a lot of autonomy, we thought, you know, had our own money.
Right.
Decided we need to make some improvements in there.
Yeah.
As we did. Uh-huh. Need to. And so with student help, and we had some students who knew metalwork, and using our own money, we put in a lighting board on the side on pipes and went up. So you could have a second floor over here off stage. It wasn't as big as this table, the whole platform we built up. So people could work under it, and the door could open underneath, but they could work above on the lights, which gives, instead of them standing over here in the middle of everything.
Yeah.
Because the platform was made for speech, really. And this gave it a chance. And then up above is the chemistry department, which sometimes would leak strange-smelling things through the floor. And so in front of the out in front of that, we took a saw. We knew how the beams ran, and cut, and they were widely spaced, just from one beam all the way across the greater beams to the next one, and then put in pipe work to hold lights, and wired it.
Okay.
So we had a front beam, which was essential. Otherwise, you couldn't get any light in anybody's face until they were inside the picture frame.
Ah.
This way, you had great light that we could build out to the auditorium for a small extension, which is great for the Shakespearean plays and all. But we did all of this on our own hook. And one day, just when we saw it through the hole this way, Brad Jones, who was, you know, more or less, I guess he was a business manager then, and walking through, and he was apoplectic. Poor Brad. He, you know, what's going on? You're wrecking this building. Who's behind this? Professor Corey? You know? Well, we were so far into it, we had to go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And it was the club's money, and the work was being... You know, it was initially, it's the way they built the building, I'll bet you, originally. But this was 1954, and that would have been 1829 or 30 or something.
It was 1841.
Okay, 48 away.
Yeah.
It was a big difference. Anyway, we modified it and then changed the seats. We took out, unbolted, to make a little center aisle.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to walk all the way through all of these narrow little seats, so you had a center space. We lost maybe 24 seats that way, but gained about 18 of them back because we came closer to the front.
I see.
So there was a center aisle and side aisles. And that's the way we left it. I don't know. It's probably not that way at all. Maybe it's been torn out by now. I don't know.
Oh, you mean the...
Lewis Auditorium.
Oh, yeah. It's the Giddings Hall is the administration building.
And so there's no Lewis Auditorium? No, well, it wasn't hard to tear it out, I can tell you. It's pretty lightly done. I don't mean us. I mean, originally, they just laid some risers in for seats when they did it. Anyway, that was the home of the Massgrafters. But because we also had the other, we claimed the chapel from time to time and got it booked in for always in the autumn before the music program was too well established.
Mm-hmm.
As the traffic allows you across the street. So we got into the building at the right time and got out again.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would do that.
Okay.
But anyway, all of that evolved pretty much in those 3 years, 52, the fall of 52 through the spring of 55.
Okay.
And then that program continued to pace when we returned from leave in the fall of 56 until, I resigned from directing the Massgrafters, which was never my contract. My contract was to teach.
Yeah.
I resigned from that in the fall of 58 for sufficient reason, I think, with the administration.
Uh-huh.
And continued teaching through the end of the year to fulfill that part of it. But that program more or less continued, I'd say, to the spring of 59.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was someone else's responsibility and whatever. I really don't know what happened after that.
But Was there ever a feeling on your part of limitations of what kind of plays you could
Well, I was produce? Always conscious of where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't disagree with that. But I also had a very broad sense of the material. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the Shakespearean plays were a little near the bone, some people can tell you. Indeed. So I had no sense of, I was just aware of, but I refused to let everything, well, but inside the parameters that I recognized, mm-hmm. we claimed complete freedom. And while we had a little trouble with a little of that occasionally, mm-hmm. very minor rumble, twice, that went all right. But I need to finish one question about, you said, Job. Mm-hmm. The plays that went to churches caused considerable awareness. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, when we were in Louisville, we were reviewed by both the Louisville Times and the Courier Journal. Cincinnati would be reviewed by the Inquirer, mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. Another time, I don't think they would do that today with plays from colleges. But in the 50s, they did.
Yeah.
And this was very good for Georgetown. Uh-huh. Very good in many ways. And many people at college were aware of that. Mm-hmm. And I think some were indifferent to that, but obviously people, all kinds of people. But one of the productions, I think it may have been in a Methodist church, because we played in churches of all denominations. Uh-huh. We generally play Baptist because of the connections of our students.
Right.
But we also played in Episcopal, Disciples of Christ, Presbyterian, Methodist, one or two Catholic, one Jewish mm-hmm. temple.
Oh.
Sure.
Interesting.
You bet there's a lot of interest and exchange in a lot of these things. Uh-huh. Anyway, and so that the program reached beyond the so-called parameters. Mm-hmm. Nobody gave us parameters, so we went where we were invited. But one of the plays was reviewed when we played in the Methodist Church of Cincinnati by the New York Times, which was nice. We learned of that about a week after. The review was a week later.
Is that right?
It wasn't the instant wire service stuff you might have today.
Right.
And I learned of it the week after it came out. You know, we were pleased. Now then, fast speed. Irene and I had a year's leave to study abroad. Left here in early June 55 and came back at the end of August 56. And the shank of that time from mid-September into June was in London. And I studied at the Central School of Speech and Drama, and she at the Central School of Arts and Crafts, and here and there, and she was working on design and historic costume mm-hmm. and painting, and I was into advanced directing and was working on a possible book for the field. I ultimately decided not to do. I felt the book had been done.
Yeah.
I really got through with it. But anyway, I did it. It was good for me. And I researched this at other places, at the British Drama League Library, which is the major library, the biggest library of theater work in England. Uh-huh. And quite a good one there in Euston Square in London. And over there I went to establish my credentials and get permission and so forth, and discovered that the executive director of the British Drama League at that time was E. Martin Brown, who was the producer who really had discovered T.S. Eliot and Christopher mm-hmm. Fry and later Robert Bolt, as of A Man for All Seasons, to name some of the pieces
yes,
that
yes,
came through
yes.
these people. And always interested in drama of religious dimension. And I had written him for information when I was doing my master's thesis.
Oh.
So I had a written sense. I was quite aware who he was. He was there, but he recognized my name and
oh.
said, come by and have tea, and I did, and we talked. And he said, you know, you did quite an interesting play I read in the New York Times. He said, just to me, went to his file, and he pulled his hand. He said, I said, oh, yeah. He said, tell me about that program. Mm-hmm. Well, out of that came the following. No more details. Across the next 6 months, he approached the Religious Drama Society in Britain, which he was the chairman of. Mm-hmm. And and because he knew from me, this was from Baptist related, he went to the English Baptist Union. Mm-hmm. and talked to Dr. F. Townley Lord, which is a great name for a minister, isn't Dr. F. Townley Lord? I love it. A marvelous man. Okay. And talked to them both and came to me and said, if you, that is the Georgetown you, can create a play to be performed in churches with your college troupe and can bring them to us in the summer of 1958. Uh-huh. This was 2+ years ahead when he was talking to me. This is early 56, he's telling me this. Then Religious Drama Society, in combination with the English Baptist Union, will help the tour. And then the British Drama League, if you will also choose a companion piece for the amateur theaters, which I call community theaters, amateur theaters.
Okay, okay.
They will tour that one. And he said that preferably should be, of course, Americana, and he said ideally probably musical for that audience.
Uh-huh.
And if for the churches, he said, your own choice, we would recommend you do something biblical when you consider where we're going.
Uh-huh.
And then he said, and you know, this will be very helpful to us because it is still against the law in England, he said this in 1956,
uh-huh,
for plays, biblical plays, to be performed in churches.
Is that right?
Which goes back to the 1500s, when they're getting rid of the excesses.
Of the Catholic Church.
Well, of the Church.
Yeah.
But the plays of the Church.
Right.
The Church, it was a Catholic church, but they threw them out because they were doing all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And things got
carried away. They banned them.
Yeah, they got rid of them. Mm-hmm. Well, that's still on the statute books, or was then.
Yeah.
And he said, but in this era of good feeling, and after the Second World War, and that you're Yanks, he said, that's fine, because you won't know that, and we'll look the other way. And he said, it will help the precedent, because we need to have the right to do this again. T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral was never given in a church in England until the 1970s. Made its way through the theaters, and with great success.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it's magnificent when it's in a cathedral setting, ideally. Anyway, so we did all that, and out of that, that's because of the touring. I went back. I spent wasted a year looking for plays, and most of the plays written for churches are really terrible.
Yeah.
They're sermons.
Yeah.
They're well intended. They come from the heart.
Yes.
But like we were talking at lunch today, you know, they have so much to deliver, they can't go anywhere. They're just kind of hung up in that.
Uh-huh.
And so I ultimately did my own version, and this time I went to Job and did my own.
Okay.
And used the authorized version, whereas the one we'd done originally was Modern English when we toured. But I trusted the Moulton Reader's Bible, the Modern American version, is what we used in 1952.
Oh.
But for this one, we went back to the authorized version, because I knew the English audience would know and love,
recognize
the King James language, or the authorized version. And we did and always did that with the Job after that. And the Job we did was quite a different show than the one we did before.
Yeah.
The other was in rags and kind of Bedouin, bright colors, you know, just, you know. And this was highly ritualized and stylized to belong in those beautiful churches.
Okay.
Basically, it was chanted and spoken and declaimed and so forth. And so that took 2 years to develop. And then it was first staged as the annual In the Chapel piece that we were doing
here
in the chapel and for the homecoming weekend in October. It gave a schedule for 3 performances. I think we held it over next weekend and gave a 4th one.
Uh-huh.
And we were continuing to shape it. We went on. We took it to the Kentucky General Association, which met in Harlan that year, which is where they passed a very fateful committee thing to do a study and
moving of the college and so forth.
Overlapping timelines on these things.
Yeah.
Because I do believe time is a curious thing. All of these times are spinning together.
I know.
And we did all of that checking around and revising. And then come the next spring, that piece, having profited by that and having had the shakedown, was tuned a bit by me. And then I chose a cast of 5 graduates and 5 promising undergraduates. So we have the...
So it was a cast of 10?
It was a cast of 10.
Okay.
And this is where 5 who had previously graduated but were excellent people, Bill Parsons and so on, were brought in, Jenny Champion. And then of the younger people who were on the campus, like Warren Hammock and Gene Diskey and so forth. So it was blending the experience of both.
Okay.
And then we rehearsed the piece here, took it to two churches and WHAS television before we took off for Canada. And eventually, finally, after the Brussels Fair, then we're in England for that month.
Okay.
And with that piece, we commissioned another piece. Remember the British Dramatic piece?
Right.
A folk piece. Commissioned Jim Payton, who was a graduate from here, a speech and drama man, and played the Job in the modern language version that went to Texas.
Oh.
And he was teaching in this area then. I think he later went to work for the state, Department of Education, I think, frankly. He's now retired, and I think probably lives around here, yeah. Anyway, and you may know him, I don't know.
No.
But anyway, Jim did for us his version of John Henry, a musical version. John Henry, the Railroad Man. And we did that highly styled with songs, folk songs. And he played the guitar, and he was the singing man who struck that, and then be songs.
Oh.
And John Henry was, you know, he... The nightclub floozies ate him up.
Yeah.
And all of that. So there was a nightclub scene.
Yeah.
And we had a little, about some of that.
Uh-huh.
And the president of the college at that time, well, it was known that the run was over.
Yeah.
And then we were going to revive because we're fitting in people. Experienced people were coming in to join, so they had to be cast in that just like they were in the Job. So that was to have a trial production too. And we learned the day before that a committee of four trustees were coming to take a look at it, to close it down and ban the tour.
Oh, really? The John Henry?
But to close down and ban the whole tour.
Oh.
Because the John Henry was going with it, it wasn't fit to be represent the college.
Okay.
So we just decided it was ready, packed the show, and they never saw it.
So you left before they came?
Well, we didn't do the show. We didn't leave till we left, but we didn't do a public show.
Oh.
We just had another rehearsal.
Oh.
You know, closed door and work and so forth.
Oh.
Hey, okay. It was a sweet, pretty little folk show. And, but the Job piece got all the attention for lots of reasons.
Yeah.
The other was very much in a certain tradition of a small, kind of folksy musical.
Now, do you think that the objections to the John Henry piece by these trustees was because it involved a black man?
No. Oh, no, no. It was first an all-white cast anyway.
Uh-huh.
You know, it wasn't that. No, it was the floozies, I would suspect.
The floozies?
The floozies.
Oh.
You know, a couple of songs.
Okay.
Probably. Which were had a fair amount of innuendo in one or two cases.
Uh-huh.
And then you go on again to the contest of the machine and...
Yes.
And the death of John Henry. And,
yes.
And the whole thing went on through until he takes his hammer and goes on across into the other place in the great beyond, and so forth. And it was pleasant. It's just that there was a little... and I later learned there was a lot of... Yeah. But at the time, I'm just telling you all I knew at the time. But that was up at the very top.
Okay.
And this particular committee was brought in by instructions, but not admitted so, to take a look.
You think on the instructions of the president?
Absolutely, without question.
And this is Dr. Edelman?
Yes, he called me in and tried to stop the tour after that.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you think he would have had any objections if he just did the Book of Job?
And not, well, and not have in the visit I've referred to, which I should mention, I was summoned. This was really before the two shows had been revived again. But they played. See, the Job had been touring the previous year.
Okay.
The usual story for a piece.
Right.
The John Henry was the spring show done in early May, ran the 2 weeks, and then closed out, and there were finals, and then we were at the interim, and just bringing back the grads to fit in and re-rehearse both shows.
Okay.
Bring them up to leave in about the third week of June.
Because y'all were going to tour that summer.
Yeah, because then we were going via Canada to perform there and then catch a ship from Montreal.
And this is 58. Sail.
This is 58.
Yeah.
So somewhere at the end of May, I was summoned through the president's office. And Dr. Harris was a dean, and he was seated in a chair behind me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was here, and you were in his, or I'm in his place, anyway.
Yeah.
And then he began talking, and
I'm in the position of the president.
Yeah, you're the
president. And you're there, and Dr. back Harris over here,
just
there.
Behind me, yes. And he also had a notepad in his hand.
Mm.
I don't know if they had tape recording machines so common then, but it wouldn't matter.
It would have been very cumbersome.
I could wish if they had, and I had the tape, it'd be fascinating to hear.
Yeah.
He proceeded to tell me how ashamed he was of the mass crafters and how embarrassed he was by them. And then he proceeded to attack the entire program all the way back from the time he'd come. We had done the Tartuffe, for example, because we did classics. And, you know, that's the play about the hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting that he said he was embarrassed by this. Somewhere, Molière would have been delighted, I think. If he was embarrassed, Molière would have been delighted.
Uh-huh.
And the Shakespeare really was not fit for mixed company.
Hmm.
Macbeth is about witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
He had all of the most narrow reads on things. And this and that, and the Hedda Gabler. Ibsen was an agnostic. It's just astonishing to listen. I just listened.
Mm-hmm.
This went on some time.
Mm.
Maybe 20 minutes.
Uh-huh.
He, as they would say, he really turned on.
Yeah.
But then the point came about England. He said, well, of course, they'll laugh you off the stage in England with that Job. He said, they know about Bedouins. People don't look like that. It looks like Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
I had nothing to say. I was just listening.
Yeah.
And, of course, we had raised our own money. Remember the mass crafters?
Right.
We had raised our own money. And the students put up some, but it was pretty well matched for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned noon, I sold a car. Yeah, my Thunderbird, yeah, that was part of it.
Okay.
And there were others too. Mrs. Alice Fogel, she did 20% of the cost.
Okay.
For us, so, which again, he didn't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I had no reason. They couldn't stop me unless he was to give me an ultimatum that my job or the tour. And he'd do that because I had tenure.
Yeah.
But then, and then he got into this also. But interestingly enough, less to me about that than the Job. The Job's not Christian, he said.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. And he's a New Testament professor. How interesting to separate
the two books.
The two because sets. The two religions are. They're mother and daughter,
uh-huh.
historically. And in many, 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 many ways, anyway. Oh. And on the, there was a song in the John Henry, which I think three girls were involved in, who played the three floozies in,
uh-huh.
there were two scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Something about, he's a railroad man and he can ride my train anytime,
yeah.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
And she did the whole thing quite properly with a nuance, which of course everybody caught.
Yeah.
But isn't that where you see people is on stage? That's right. And, well, he did refer to that, but mostly he spent his time about the Job. And,
mm-hmm.
And he said there, you know, he said there are things in the Bible that should be read only in the bathroom or the bedroom.
Now that's interesting.
That was one of his phrases. I remember certain phrases. I clearly remember,
uh-huh.
and that they would laugh you off the stage, and you people really, you should just stay here.
Now by this time he had been president 6 years, right?
No, he was president only 4 years, 4.5 years.
I was trying to get my chronology right.
Yeah, he came. He started, I believe, June 1, 1954.
Okay.
And he resigned before Thanksgiving. November 1958. So he was about 4.5 years, I guess. That's right, roughly. That's pretty close to it.
Okay.
Maybe 4 years and 7 months ago.
And by this time, the controversy related to moving...
None of this had yet surfaced.
Oh, about moving the college?
No, that would be blowing up in the fall.
Okay.
Because this
so this is in May of 58.
May of 58, the end of May 58. Our tour was the summer of 58.
But all this is probably turning underneath the surface.
I know it was. Yeah. I knew then things were stirring.
Uh-huh.
And because it was not public, it made one's interest greater.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's one of the things that was done wrong. Even if the concept might have been a pretty good idea in theory,
mm-hmm.
the way it was done was so... Anyway, that's another matter. But that was prior to that public explosion. That event became public knowledge in Kentucky when in late August 58, the Courier-Journal got hold of this and did a front page story about it, and did several, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But we just held our own.
So when you're sitting there and he's talking to you, what emotions are going through you?
Well...
I know
it
you
was
say you're sitting there silent.
It
everything.
Was such a performance. I was fascinated with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have lots of interests, historically, and literary, and people, and mm-hmm. so on. So all those things were working. And I noticed the man back here. He didn't have much to write about, because he really wasn't writing unless I talked.
Oh, I see.
I have good peripheral vision. They taught me that in the Navy.
Yeah.
My eyes are better this way than they are out to the centers today. Uh-huh. I'm still a good vision this way. And so I can really see right to there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so only when I responded was any note taken, which, again, I understood what must be happening. I had nothing particular to say other than that we're going. People are expecting us. We owe it to people.
Mm-hmm.
People in England, people who have given to make it happen, the young people who are going, I said a few things like that.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry you cannot wish us well. And
did this strike you from your historical perspective, something like the Inquisition or an English star chamber?
It's again, now something else he disliked was the Crucible. We staged the Crucible.
Okay. Arthur Miller?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
He didn't like that either. He went through the whole repertoire. He didn't like one of them. There's one exception. He did not object to one, so I presume he liked it.
Mm-hmm.
The one he did not object to was Philip Turner, the English writer's play called Christ in the Concrete City, which is one of the plays we toured. And his daughter, his elder daughter,
mm-hmm.
was in that show. And she did a very good job. This girl was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And we played that all over, including Ridgecrest and so forth and so on.
Okay.
But in reference to that general concept, not that play,
yeah.
but all the plays he had seen, he was against every one of them, but did not mention that one. But there was something wrong with each one. And
did he root it in a theological objection?
Well, it was always on an ethical, moral connection.
Mm-hmm.
Would you, theological without being doctrinally explicit.
Uh-huh.
But it was very much in the manner of a Tartuffe or